Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftakt. Der neue Toyota Yaris-Hybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat. Ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit. Und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
Starting Grid. Die Formel-1-Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Sophie Affeld. In Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de. Keep racing auf meinsportpodcast.de.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Starting Grid, dem Formel-1-Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Ich bin Sophie Affeld und ihr hört heute keine Rennanalyse oder Vorschau, sondern eine neue Ausgabe unserer Interviewserie Frauen im Motorsport. Der ein oder andere wird sich vielleicht noch daran erinnern, dass Kevin vor einiger Zeit schon viele verschiedene Rennfahrerinnen interviewt hat. Das lege ich euch natürlich auch nochmal ans Herz, da reinzuhören, wenn ihr das noch nicht getan habt. Und ich dachte mir, wir führen das heute mal ein bisschen fort, schauen dieses Mal allerdings nicht auf eine Fahrerin, sondern auf eine der Heldinnen hinter den Kulissen, so nenne ich es jetzt mal. Und zwar hört ihr im Folgenden ein Interview mit Dalia Damos-Gerra. Dalia arbeitet als Head of Test and Build bei Alpine in der Fabrik in Enstone. Also frei übersetzt ist sie die Teamleiterin der Bau- und Testabteilung. Was es genau bedeutet, wird sie euch natürlich gleich selbst erzählen. Unter anderem geht es da auch um Themen wie die Sitzanpassung der Fahrer und die Homologation des Autos, aber auch um vieles mehr. Außerdem sprechen wir natürlich auch über Dalias Weg in den Motorsport und darüber, wie es ist, eine von wenigen Frauen in einer Formel-1-Fabrik zu sein. Zwei kleine Hinweise noch vorweg. Dalia kommt aus Mexiko, daher wird das Interview auf Englisch sein und wir haben das Gespräch schon Ende Juni geführt, also das ist schon einige Wochen her. Zu diesem Zeitpunkt waren sowohl Laurent Rossi als auch Ottmar Schaffenhauer noch im Amt, also wundert euch nicht, wenn diese Namen zwischendurch fallen. Und damit würde ich sagen, gehen wir in das Gespräch und ich wünsche euch viel Spaß damit. Hi Dalia, thank you for being here with me today and thank you for being part of this Women in Motorsport series and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks Sophie, it's a real pleasure to be with you. I wish I could speak such a nice German, but I hope it's going to be okay for everyone.
Yeah, I think it will do, no worries. So Dalia, as I already said in German, you are the head of test and build at BWT Alpine Formula One team. I think there are a lot of jobs in F1 that most fans don't even know of probably, and I think yours maybe could be one of those. So we're going to dive into the details a bit later, but could you maybe explain in a few words what your job is about?
Absolutely. So Alpine is one of the few works teams, which means that we make our own car, we design our car and we make it in-house. So basically, I'm part of the operations of that and I'm responsible of the last part of the car before it is delivered to the track. So that means all the mechanical assembly, all the sub-assemblies, everything, you know, powertrain, fuel system, hydraulics, all the small components that go inside the cars, wheel, etc. Then we also have a pre-fit department, which is basically where we pre-fit all the chassis. And I have also the validation testing area, which is where we do all the mechanical tests for all the components. So basically, just making sure that it all goes well together.
How does a typical day in the factory look like for you? Is there even such a thing as a typical day or is every day very different?
Yeah, I think it is more like every day very different. We always start the day with a morning huddle just to catch up with all the operations, just to understand where everything is at the factory on the day. But after that, it pretty much depends on what's happening. I try to spend a lot of time in the shop floor because, as I said, I'm responsible of 3 or 4 departments on the shop floor. So I try to spend most of the time with them. But there is a lot of negotiations and a lot of work that happens with the other departments like engineering, designers, control systems. So I spend a lot of my time as well negotiating and working with them. Obviously, if there's been a race or if there's something happening with the car, then a lot of our time then is focusing on how are we going to resolve that or how are we going to make sure that we get the next upgrade or whatever it is to the track on time.
So it sounds like you have a lot of different tasks. I also read that your team is responsible, for example, for producing the tools the pit crews are using for the races as well, and that you're also looking after the cars that the F1 Alpine Academy members are using. So there are a lot of different things. Can you tell me how many people are actually working in your department to do all this?
Yeah, so in build and test, we are about 48 people at the moment. It's a department that is growing, and that's split into three main departments, but one of the departments is split into other three sub-departments. So it's quite extensive. It's a big number of people, but I think what we do is very diverse as well. It's very, you know, it's not that like a typical production line where you have the same component happening all the time, but it's, you know, like everyone has very specific and different skills.
And I would imagine when you say that you are like responsible for three or four different departments, that that also means that you not only have to be good on the engineering side, but also on working with people. Would you agree with that? And what would you say are the skills that are the most vital for your role in general?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you just nailed that, because I think from the technical side, I think the most important skill that goes in front of everything is being able to work under pressure. You know, everything we do is always going to be under pressure, and it's always going to be, you know, a lot of stress around it. So it's about keeping calm and just making sure that decision making and understanding technical, the technical specifications and all that part of the car is, you know, it is working well. But something that is very, very important, and I think that's something that I believe in the engineering companies we tend to dismiss a bit, is the soft skills, is the leadership skills, is the being able to understand people, making sure that they are okay and that they are at their best all the time. Because at the end of the day, they are the people who are doing the job. They are the ones that are putting the car together. They are the ones who are, you know, day in, day out, making this happen. So it's very important for me that I can lead them correctly, that I can give them the right direction, but also that I can understand them, but I can understand their needs, that I can provide them with what they need. And equally, when I work with other departments, you know, there is a lot of negotiation going on, and there is a lot of trying to pursue both parts' best interests. So there is a lot of people's skills that sometimes I believe we tend to dismiss, and that's when it becomes quite difficult.
I think you said that very well. Like, I can imagine that it's very important to realize what the team needs to perform at its best, because it obviously also brings the best result in the end, probably. Dalia, you joined Alpine in June 2021. We are going to talk about your career path a little bit later on, but your first task at the team definitely wasn't an easy one, because as we all know, 1 year later, we started into a new era in F1 in 2022 with new regulations, the ground effect made its return, for example. How big of a challenge was it building this 2022 car, also considering that you were pretty new to the whole F1 environment in general?
Yeah, it's interesting, because everything was new for me there. So when I arrived, we were already talking about car build. Car build for us is the winter season, which is when we are preparing the car for the next season. And that should normally start, you know, it starts being more aggressive towards the end of the year, and then the beginning of the new year, it's absolutely crazy. And it was very interesting, because everyone was talking about this is going to be the worst car build in ages, and it's going to be very heavy. And because I didn't know what to expect, really, everything was new and everything was kind of welcome to me. You know, like, it was very tough. Yes, we spent very, very long hours in the factory, but I was only getting my head around everything at that point. So I didn't have any baseline. You know, I just knew that it was a lot of hard work and a lot of hours, and, you know, some things going wrong. And then people, as soon as I arrived, one of the key members left the team. So, you know, it was being left with all the testing area just on my own for the new car. So that was a bit scary, but I also think that I was a bit ignorant to how bad it was going to be. So in a certain side, you know, that was good as well, because I, you know, as I said, everything was new to me. So I was just kind of opening my eyes. It was very challenging for my team. I know that, because they are people who have a lot of experience, and they are people who have done this for many, many years, and themselves were like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how this goes together. I don't understand this system yet. So I was trying to help them as much as I could. But obviously, if they were the experts and didn't know, then it was going to be even more challenging for me. But I think that the 23 car build was probably more stressful for me, because then I knew what was going to happen. Then I knew what I had to do exactly. And then I knew how things had to go. So when something was not going according to plan, I knew it was going wrong. So I think although the car itself was easier, for me, was a bit more like, right, I have no excuse here. I own this. Now let's try and get it done.
That's interesting, because I would have asked you about this year's car, so I didn't expect that answer. But yeah, it's very funny, actually. I mean, an F1 car consists obviously of many, many individual parts. Like, we have the gearbox, suspension, aero parts, brakes, etc. Do you actually know how many different or single parts are coming together from one car?
We are talking in the range of hundreds of thousands.
That's a lot.
Hundreds of thousands, yeah.
Yeah, so also a lot of parts that need to be assembled. I guess it can get quite stressful sometimes. You also talked about a bit about that in your previous answer. I'm not sure yet at which time of the year the listeners will hear this podcast, but at the time we are recording this, it's the end of June, which means we are also in the middle of an F1 season. How is the stress level at the moment in the test and build department? Or what is the most stressful time of the year in general for you? Is that the winter period when you are building the car together?
Yes, exactly. So I would say that at the moment we are in a stress levels in F1 are always going to be higher than anywhere else. But it's a little bit stable, especially now that we are in the European races, because obviously we have a little bit more time to send parts. And, you know, it feels that we are a little bit more in our, I don't want to say comfort zone, but, you know, we know how long it's going to take to get something from Enstone to Austria, or, you know, even Silverstone. But definitely the winter season, that's the most stressful part, because we need to, especially because of, we need to start a little bit early. So that means that we are still finishing one season. We are still delivering the car, you know, to the truck, and still need to do very well. But we are already looking at the new car. We are already putting it together. We are already trying to make it work. And we know that anything that gets delayed is going to make it very challenging towards the winter testing. And obviously, once we get closer and closer to winter testing, that's when days are really, really long, really, really stressful, because then you start running out of time to, you know, to make things up and correct anything. And I think that's where, and again, because most of it is new, then when we are testing, when we are putting things together, we are only discovering new things, and sometimes, you know, things we need to fix, things we need to change. So that's where the most, you know, the most stressful and the busiest part of the year is.
Talking about stressful situations, like, how do you deal with them personally? Did you find a way yet to stay cool in these situations when maybe not everything is going according to plan?
It's interesting, because I think in the specific moments, I think that's something that you learn with time. I think if I try to remember, you know, myself 10 or 12 years ago when I started my career, I was really bad at dealing with the stressful situations, and I was getting into troubles very, very often, because I would just explode, or I would just, you know. And I think over time I've been getting better at it. Sometimes I surprise myself that I can react in a very calm manner, and I can stay objective. And even when I feel that, okay, this is bigger than me, I can just stop and, you know, go out, take some air, and then come back and, you know, try and breathe and make the right decisions. I think that's something that I've been learning with time, definitely with experiences. But in general, as in my life, I always need time to switch off every day. Every day, I like going to the gym. I'm actually working towards a personal trainer certification, because that's something that I like to do outside work. And that's something that is like a like the place where I find some refuge, where I can just, you know, escape a little bit. And even, for example, even during car build, which is very long days and challenging situations, I try to, you know, disconnect for at least an hour to go do some exercise, because I know that that's the time that my mind is going to reset, and, you know, everything is kind of going to go a little bit back to normal in my body, and then I can be ready to go again.
I think that's very important, right? To just keep your mind off of work sometimes, especially in these stressful periods. And as you already said, like, F1 is such a high pressure environment. So I think it's really important to also take care of yourself to not burn out in the end. And I'm sure that helps your team in the end as well, of course. And I think actually people might underestimate how much work is going on in the factory, also before the start of a new season, because there's a lot to do, obviously. And one thing I want to talk about briefly is the seat fit, because it's something that obviously happens every year, because every driver has a seat that's adapted to him personally. And I think your team is responsible for that as well, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So basically, we have a generic speed bucket, which is literally a bucket. That's what we generically design with some of the information we have from the drivers. But on the day we do the seat fit, it's something very manual. It's quite interesting because we do that, as you said, in my department. We have the final build department where we do all the pre-fit. So we put the chassis, the current chassis, we put the bucket, and then the driver has to get all dressed up as if they were going for the race, and then they get into the car, and we have a foam which is in a liquid state, and then you pour that foam between the feet and the driver, and then it starts expanding and it takes the shape of the driver, and then it's all about, you know, like polishing that and making sure the driver is comfortable, that they can move around and stuff. Then we scan it, and then that's how we get the final seat for them.
Is it very different from driver to driver what they want and what they need, or is it very similar usually?
It is different. Yeah, it is different. Obviously, they are all different. We have Ocon, for example, who is super, super tall. But also, it, you know, they have different preferences on how they like to move, or, you know, how they like to hold the steering wheel and things like that, pedals. And yeah, I don't think we could use the same seat with two different drivers.
I think Esteban Ocon is actually the tallest driver on the grid, I think, so yeah. This probably might make a difference. So the seat fit is one thing that needs to be done before the season, but there are also other things on the, let's say, to-do list. For example, as we know, the car in its part also has to go through a homologation process before it can hit the racetrack. Can you maybe also take us through this process a bit? How does that work?
Yeah, the homologation process, I think, is one of the most stressful, because first thing you have to do is you have to book the FIA. And it's always tricky because you always aim for a date. But, you know, if things go wrong, you know, and obviously it's a time where the FIA personnel are very busy because all the teams need to do their homologation. So first thing is we need to book the FIA. Once they are, some tests are made in-house, some others are in a different facility. But basically it's purely having the chassis or the component that we, the structural component we are going to test. They are just like witnessing everything, and we have to apply different loads in different positions just to make sure that it's all safe. So the main objective of the homologation is making sure that everything is safe. So we literally just apply more and more and more loads, and then at the end the FIA just check displacements, or if there is anything going on the chassis, they sometimes ask you to repeat something. But hopefully when everything goes well, they literally just inspect everything and then just thumbs up and then move to the next one. It's quite stressful, to be honest. I did witness few of them, and I found it very stressful, so I prefer to be there for a little bit and then sneak out, because it just feels that anything can break at any point, but obviously it doesn't. It's really interesting.
Can imagine that. And you're probably very happy when this stuff is all done then, and when all this pre-season work is done, sooner or later there comes the day when the season finally kicks off, which is usually the day the pre-season testing begins, if we like ignore all the filming days, etc., for a second. And that's usually the end of February, the beginning of March. But the work doesn't stop for you, does it? Like, what are you responsible for during the actual season when all the pre-season stuff is done?
Yeah, the work never stops here. We always have to make sure that we maintain enough quantities for the race team. So if anything happens at the track, we have to replenish those quantities. But also we are always working on upgrades, always, always, you know. And even if it's just development work, or when we have actually found the upgrade that we want to make, then we have to make it real and we have to make it possible. So in reality, we are always, we never stop. It's always, you know, we're always targeting the next race and the next race and the next upgrade. When parts come back to the factory after the races, I'm also responsible for servicing and maintaining them. So that's the other thing. Even if everything goes super smoothly and nothing breaks and no one crashes, which not always happens, but even if it was like that, we need to receive parts back on the factory, give them service and maintenance, and then send them back to the track. So it's always, you know, it's constantly working and constantly under pressure as well, because typically when you get parts back for service, you don't have many days to do that. You normally have, I don't know, 2-3 days, depending when parts need to go out for the next race. So it's always constant on the clock.
And that's probably especially stressful with all the double headers and triple headers going on. Are you also in contact with the drivers? Are they giving you feedback as well, or are they more talking to the development department and that side?
We mostly get the feedback through their engineers, really, and that feedback comes to us. We constantly get that because obviously, for example, I'm responsible for making the pedals to ensuring, you know, all the shafts on the steering wheel and things like that at the right level. All the hydraulic system, they could also have preferences on the hydraulic system there. So we always get that, but we mainly get it through the engineering department. When they come to the factory, they are always happy to give feedback, so they sometimes I spend time with my department just like chatting about certain things. But yeah, let's say that in a more regular basis is through their engineering team.
Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftrag. Der neue Toyota Yaris-Hybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat. Ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit. Und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
Von 0 auf 100. Aral feiert 100 Jahre mit über 100.000 Gewinnen. Zum Beispiel ein Jahr frei tanken. Jetzt ein Dankeschön, Rubbellos zu jedem Einkauf. Alle Infos auf aral.de. Aral, alles super.
Okay, so your team obviously has to react to the feedback after the race weekend is finished or even earlier. But how is it like for you during the weekend? Do you also have to work on Saturdays and Sundays? Are you able to watch the race? What is it like?
Yeah, I try to be on top of the race and, you know, because try to disconnect a little bit as well. Sometimes it's more difficult than others. Friday race in the factory is normally very, very quiet because everything that we have to do for the race, we've done it already. We kind of handed over to the race team. So that's when most people would take the chance to have a little break. But obviously we start watching FP1, FP2. If everything goes well, then happy days. If not, then, you know, Friday crisis here in the factory. And sometimes the race team get in touch with certain questions during the race weekend. If we've done all the right planning, that doesn't happen, you know, too much. But yeah, most of the times I have the opportunity to just enjoy the race on the Sunday, but it's difficult to disconnect. You see something and you want to go on your phone and see what happened, what is my responsibility, what's going to happen, you know, so it's difficult. But yeah, I try to do my best to disconnect and enjoy the race.
Are you nervous watching the races?
Oh, yes. Oh yes, very, very. To be honest, I think the more I get into these, it's the more nervous I get watching the races. Sometimes I wish I could just watch them like any other. You know, that they just get excited, and if there is a big crash, they just, you know, shout and get all this excitement. But yeah, I'm afraid that's no longer possible for me because there is always, you know, this thing on the back of my mind. And hopefully it's not my car. Hopefully we didn't do anything wrong. And you know, it is great, but yeah, it's that moment of nervousness as well.
I think it would be the same for me actually. And I think there are always like bad and good moments, right? Like you have crashes, as you said, where you think, oh no, please not our car, and then also some good results obviously. But what would you say, when is a race weekend for you personally a success? Is there a definition?
I think obviously the points, that's, you know, I mean, that is success for everyone because we want our car to do better. We do have our own target, we have a journey, and we want to get on top of the grid, but we know that we need to go, you know, through the journey, so it's not going to happen overnight. So when we beat that target sometimes is, you know, one of the opponents, one of the teams that are very close to us or things like that. Even when it doesn't look like we got the most points, but we know we've done what we wanted to do, then, you know, that's success for us. But the other one is, it's funny, but probably when there is no disaster, that is also success, you know, because once we've done something wrong in my team, we will know and it will be really, really sad. But when we've done everything right, it's like we won't really see it just because we will know that the car is correct. You know, it's not going to be as noisy as if something goes wrong. But the fact that, you know, we come and we realize that we had no issues with the building, we had no issues with the components, that's also success for me.
And I guess it's also very important to, you know, have a good result every once in a while, like podiums or victories, maybe even just to keep the team motivated, even if you're not like a regular contender for wins or podiums. But you already did witness some big results during your time with the team, I think. When I think back to 2021, obviously, with Esteban Ocon's win in Hungary, also Fernando Alonso's podium in Qatar when he was still part of the team. Yeah. And obviously, most recently, also the podium, the third place of Esteban in Monaco. How were these moments for you? How rewarding is it to get these results in with all the hard work you're putting in?
No, well, it's amazing because at the end of the day, I mean, I do this for life, you know? My life is around this and that's where I put most of my energy, my time, my efforts, my everything is going to that. So obviously, you know, when we have a good result like those, it is difficult not to cry because, you know, it's so rewarding. So like everything you've done, you know, was worth is really, really good. And it's interesting how also everything goes so fast. You know, whatever you were doing during the week, you will see the results on the weekend. So it's very, you know, I don't know, it is incredible. It's like you are always at this high energy, high pace. And when it goes well, then, you know, it just gets exacerbated and it's amazing.
Yeah, I think that's understandable if you're putting so much effort into all of this. And the part of the team that is on site obviously gets to celebrate these podiums or victories directly at the track, at least if there's enough time until the flight home or to the next race. But do you also get to celebrate these victories or podiums in the factory in Enstone as well?
Well, yeah,
maybe
no, absolutely.
A few days later. Yeah.
Because we know, you know, it's all our effort. So we are about 900 employees in Enstone at the moment. I think the personnel that are traveling is about 9% of all the employees. So the majority of the people are in the factory and the majority of the people are the ones that are here every day, every single day, day in, day out, trying to make that possible. So for us, it's a big deal because even when we are not at the track doing, you know, on TV and stuff, it's all our efforts going to that as well. So yeah, no, by all means, when we come back on Monday, you know, the energy is amazing in the factory. And normally we would have some champagne or something with Otmar Monday, Tuesday, whenever he's back and, you know, everyone could celebrate together. Yeah, absolutely.
That's great to hear. And hope you can do that a little bit more often very soon. We already talked about the fact that your job is factory-based, but I actually saw some pictures on your Instagram account from the Mexican Grand Prix. I'm not sure which year it was. Maybe also 2022. And yeah, okay, all right, 2022. Yeah. How did the opportunity came about to join the team there?
Well, to be honest, Lauren Rossi, who is our Alpine CEO, the first time we had a one-to-one, he said, you should come to the Mexican Grand Prix. But yeah.
You are from Mexico. Maybe we should say that. I think we didn't mention that before. So kind of a home race for you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm from Mexico City. So when I have my first one-to-one with him and we talk about that, then that's why he said, yeah, you should come to Mexico. So yeah, just, you know, didn't know what to expect. It's important for the factory people to go to the races because you realize what's happening there. It's like in everywhere, you know, you have to understand how the other side is working, what their needs are. And in that way, you will be able to work better with them because you will understand them better. So, you know, the company is trying to make the effort to send more people to the track to understand and see how we can do things differently here, but also to appreciate the work that we are doing because we live in the factory, you know, we don't tend to have all that adrenaline with everyone else. And it is very different at the track. So, yeah, for me, it was a little bit of that, of understanding the impact of my role at the track, but it was also leaving all that energy and all that adrenaline and, you know, all the team spirit and the day that everyone is competing. And it was just amazing. And as you said, it's my home race for me. So even being in my country was, you know, one of the best experiences ever.
And you obviously also had the chance to experience the whole atmosphere there. And I think the fans in Mexico are quite passionate about F1, aren't they?
Very passionate. Very yeah. passionate. I think Mexican people, we are quite well known for being passionate about, you know, everything. And with Checo Perez doing so well this season, it's just been, you know, growing and growing. Drive to Survive and all of it is just growing massively in Mexico.
It would be great to have some more Mexican drivers. Who do we have? Like maybe Pedro Ward, or I think Rafael Villagomez is in a free at the moment, but still a long way to go. But yeah, obviously it would be great for the Mexican fans to yeah have someone in F1, even if Sergio Perez won't be there anymore in a few years, maybe. We talked quite a lot about your job now, I think. Maybe one last question to end this part of the interview, to finish it off on a positive note. What for you personally is the best thing about your job? What do you enjoy most about it?
Probably the biggest thing for me is the people. I enjoy people. I've always liked to work with people. It's one of my passions, really, to do things for people. And, you know, it's just what gives me energy to be surrounded by people. So that's something I really enjoy. This is, as I mentioned, this is a very people-intense job. And obviously, the fact that we are, you know, anything I do, it's going to be reflected in millions and millions of screens over the weekend. So that pace is also very interesting, because everything you do just gets, like, you know, it's exacerbated so much, and it's rewarded, and, you know, it's seen so many places. It's great. But also the visibility that's given me to do things differently and to, you know, break some stereotypes and, you know, try and support the generations that are just starting, and try and give, you know, as a female in a male-dominated environment, you know, try and give that example, which I didn't expect this job to have. For me, it was just a job. But now that I realize the impact it's having, I think it is just amazing. It's, you know, that I couldn't expect more from my job, I think.
That's lovely to hear. And obviously, we are going to talk about this women in motorsport topic in a few minutes. But before that, I would like to know how you actually got in the position you're in today. So I would like to know how you made your way into the world of F1. Did you always have a passion for cars, or was it more or less like coincidence that you ended up in the automotive or motorsport environment?
I always loved cars. That's something that since I was a child, I've always liked. I grew up with mostly male cousins who love cars. So, you know, I was always going out with them, and we were always going to see like all the super sports cars and fancy cars and all of that. And I've got that from my dad as well. But I have to confess that I didn't follow F1 before. I think it was a little bit out of my radar. I think when I grew up in Mexico, it was more like an elite sport. You know, it wasn't for everyone. So I kind of didn't look there. And to be honest, when I started my career in the UK, I kind of always tried to get into the automotive industry. Then I went into aerospace, but I always kept an eye on automotive. And even when I was looking for this role, I wasn't really sure what F1, you know, what a job in F1 was, because I didn't know that, because I've always done manufacturing. I've always been in factories, which is what I love. And I didn't know that actually there were the works teams that would have their own manufacturing size where I could do the same job I was doing in aerospace or something similar, but making F1 cars. So it was a bit, let's say, a bit of a coincidence when I was looking for roles, and then I realized, oh, there is a job in F1. How does this work? And then I started getting into it, and then obviously, you know, it just worked out. I think it was the right time for both the team and myself. But yeah, that's how it happened.
So you said that you're always... You were always interested in cars in general. But there are obviously a lot of jobs also in the automotive environment. So why did you decide to go into the field of engineering in the end?
Well, I've always liked the challenging side of it. I don't like to do things in the most common way, I believe. So So when I decided to study engineering, I just wanted to, I love maths, I love physics. So I wanted to use that. But also I wanted to do something very challenging and something that could really make a difference, you know, something that could really change things, could really change the world. And that's how I got into that really.
You first went to university in Mexico then to become a mechatronics engineer. I know that in the UK, for example, there are a lot of possibilities to study engineering, also many, many variations. How was the situation in Mexico back then? How popular was engineering, or especially mechatronics engineering over there?
So when I went to uni, not many years ago, mechatronics engineering was fairly new in the country. And again, I wanted to do the most challenging engineering. So
of course. Mechatronics.
Yeah, and you know, it had the fame that it was very difficult, it was very new, but also it was very innovative, and it was, you know, it was going to change the world. So this is what I want to do. But I think engineering has a very big offer in Mexico, to be honest. We have very good universities. Mexico produces a lot of engineers. The manufacturing industry is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, economic activity in the country. And actually, automotive industry is massive. It's the biggest one. And aerospace is growing now. So I think we have a passion for that. For me, it was about that. But also, I wanted to study. I always wanted to go to prestigious universities. And that meant that I always needed to have scholarships. So that was another other thing for me, that, you know, I needed to pursue a place where I could get a very good scholarship, that everything would be paid for. And, you know, I just wanted to prove myself, I think, and do it in the best way. So that was the way, I believe.
I can imagine it's quite challenging at times also, right? Like especially if you say you had a scholarship and you always need to push very hard so you have good results and don't end up losing it and stuff like that. But yeah, I think it kind of shows that you're also a very hardworking person. I think that, yeah, it's also necessary for working in F1 probably. You then decided not to do your master's degree in Mexico. Instead, you moved to the UK. You already talked about that a bit. And there you studied manufacturing, engineering and management in Nottingham. Was it always something you wanted to do, to study abroad, or was it more that you were forced to go there because there were more work opportunities or things like that?
To be honest, I always wanted to do a master's degree, but I wanted to do it abroad. It was about making it abroad. When I was in last year of university, I had the opportunity to do an exchange semester in Sweden. And for me, that was the most amazing experience, because I realized that we have so many different cultures in the world and so many different ways of doing things, and we merge together in a way for one objective. So in that moment, I realized that I really wanted to do my post degree abroad. I just wanted to keep experiencing that. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to experience new things. So it was actually more challenging to convince. So I got the scholarship from my government to come to the UK to do my master's. And it was a bit more challenging to prove to them that I needed to do it outside the country rather than inside, because obviously you have to justify that, because they will invest a lot of money on you. And they say, well, we can offer you that master's degree in the country. Why would you go abroad? So, you know, it was like, I really need to make this work. But yeah, it was about finding something new. I had actually never been in England before I moved here. I didn't know anything about Nottingham. It was just about going and explore new worlds and see new things and just have new experiences. And I think most of the things that I've done in my life, most of the big decisions have been because I just want to discover something new. Yes, I have a field where I am developing. I have my professional career, but it's really been permeated by the fact that I want to see something new and discover new things. What else is there, you know?
And that you were in Sweden maybe helped you also to go to the UK afterwards. So it wasn't that much of a cultural shock, maybe, as it would have been without the experience. Because I can imagine, I've never been to Mexico, but I can imagine that it's, yeah, quite a different life there, actually.
It is.
Yeah. So you then finished your degree in 2014, I think, which means that it was finally time to join the working world. So what did you do right after you finished university?
Well, actually, I had been working in Mexico. So when I finished my degree in Mexico, I joined Procter & Gamble there. I was working there for a couple of years. And that was mainly because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I only knew I wanted to travel. So I decided to start working, save some money. That's where I started in manufacturing. And I realized, like, well, this is for me, you know, working in a factory where you have the technical stuff, but you also have the people, and then you have the product that you see, you know, like as a finished product of what you are doing. So that's when I discovered I wanted to do manufacturing. Then I came for my master's degree. And really, when I finished the master's degree, I didn't really know where to go. I just wanted to keep exploring the world. So I tried to get into an automotive company, didn't make it. And one of my friends convinced me to apply to Rolls-Royce, because most of my colleagues were very crazy about going to aerospace in Rolls-Royce. And purely when I was reading about what they had to offer, the thing that really got my attention was you could do attachments abroad. You could go and work somewhere else in a different country if you join the graduate scheme. So I thought, okay, that's what I want to do. So yeah, so I started in Rolls-Royce at the beginning in 2015, and I stayed with them for 6.5 years. I worked in Scotland, in Germany, and then 2 or 3 different cities in England as well. So yeah, it was an amazing journey there as well.
So if you're mentioning Germany, I obviously have to ask you about it, being on a German podcast. How did you like it? I mean, you can't say something negative now, obviously, but you were in Berlin, right?
Yes, Berlin. Yeah, I think it was very different to the UK. It was a bigger cultural shock than I thought it was going to be. Very, very different. But I think it was, work-wise, it's very easy. German people at work were very driven and very objective and very to the point, which is something that I really like. So yeah, that was good. And it was during the summer as well. So I think, it was an amazing summer there. But I also realized how much I had work to adapt to the culture in England. And I think that's something I didn't think about before I moved. You know, I realized that actually I've been putting a lot of effort to make a life here, you know, to adapt to the culture, to learn how to live in this country. So I really valued that at that point, and that's where I decided to come back to England and settle here for a while.
And you are still there for your job at Alpine, obviously. We've already talked about how you've had engineering jobs before, also in different areas. And people always talk about F1 being the pinnacle of motorsport. From what you've experienced so far, would you say that Formula One is also the pinnacle of engineering?
Yes, I think so. The way we do things here is like you are always working with prototypes. It's like you are always developing. And that's something that I see very different to aerospace, for example, because in aerospace, you have the chance to develop something and then you try it and then you develop it further and then you mature that concept. And then, you know, it's the phases are much more established and they are longer. And, you know, the technology is not too different to the technology we have in F1. But the difference with F1 is that you are always trying different things. You are always trying, if it didn't work for this weekend, then you move on. And that obviously, you know, means that you are always pushing the boundaries of engineering, which is really, really interesting.
You've already mentioned a few times now that you're a big fan of challenges. Is that also a reason why you decided to go into the field of F1?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, like the main thing and the very first thing is that when I read the role description, it was the next challenge for me. It was exactly what I wanted to do, because there were other jobs in F1 that probably I could have done more easily because they were exactly what I was doing before with a little tweak, just probably the industry. And I felt like, well, I know I can do this because I've done it already. So it doesn't seem that challenging. And I wanted the step up. I wanted, you know, something that had the new thing and something, you know, yeah, just something that could challenge me again. And that was this role. So I think it was a combination of that's what I want to do next as a role and then in the industry.
Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftakt. Der neue Toyota Yaris-Hybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat. Ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit. Und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
Speaking of challenges, I already said it a few minutes ago that I want to talk about this topic, and it's obvious because the title of this podcast series is Women in Motorsport, and you are currently talking to me because you are a woman working in the business, and there are more women coming into the sport, but you're still currently part of a minority, and that's also one of the things I want to talk about briefly. I don't know about you, but I luckily always mostly get positive feedback when I'm telling people that I'm doing something related to F1, but there's always this element of surprise first. Do you experience the same, that people are still surprised when you are telling them about your job simply because you're female?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But to be honest, I'm quite used to it. So for me, it didn't change anything when I joined F1. You know, it's always been because I'm an engineer, because I work in aerospace, because I work in F1. Yeah, people don't expect it, and it's fair enough. The other day I was partying and they asked me if I was a nurse. Nothing wrong with being a nurse, but you know, I was actually with some other female friends, and this guy came and said, oh, so are you all girls nurses? And I said, no. Why do you say that? And he says, oh, because people go to England to be nurses. And I was like, actually, half of them have a PhD, we're all engineers, and I'm working F1, so no. We're not nurses.
God. Yeah, there's still a long way to go. Let's say it that way. Did it scare you off at any point that the business is so male dominated? Because I think you said earlier that it didn't really cross your mind, right?
Not really, but again, I think it's because I'm used to it. You know, when I was working in Rolls-Royce, it was quite the same. Because of the area where I am, factories, you know, it's always the same. So for me, it wasn't different, really. It was quite interesting because when I first started here, people were like, are you sure? Are you sure you're going to be okay? It's really male-dominated. I was like, yeah, but it's normal, isn't it? Like, for me, it is not different at all. And of course, there are some moments where I believe I don't realize anymore, but surely there are moments when I feel intimidated because most of the time, 99% of the time, I'm the only female in the room. So, you know, and especially in the factory, we are moving very, very fast to become more diverse. But it's also true that, you know, it's very, not only the male dominating, but also it's that, you know, most of the population are British and same range of ages and things like that. So, yeah, surely there are moments where that intimidates me without me realizing. And surely there are behaviors that I don't even notice that I, you know, that people have or that I have. But at least on the conscious level, it's not something that could put me off. Definitely not.
But you definitely bring diversity to Alpine as a team as well. Like, of course, being female and then in a minority there. But I think I also read that with you joining the team, you also became the first female engineer from Mexico. Is that true?
Yes. And that's one of the things that the country is appreciating a lot. The first Mexican female in F1.
How important do you think it is as a company in general to have diversity, like no matter if it's gender, cultures or whatever?
It's super important. And I think the company has realized that very recently. I can tell that from 2 years ago when I joined, I can really see the difference. When I joined, I think we were about 11% females. We are now in the range of 13. And it's, you know, it's 2%, yeah, but it is a big number when you think about how the team is growing. We have more nationalities as well, which we didn't have when I arrived. So that's obviously that's because, you know, all the industries in general are realizing that collective intelligence, you know, it's not only about showing that we are diverse. No. It actually, the results are better. Actually, we think much better when you have diversity. We bring more ideas to the table. We perform better. Collective intelligence is something very, very important. And I think the company has now realized that. And there is a very big push to get that, you know, to make it real now.
And being with Alpine, you already mentioned that you're also part of a team that is progressively trying to promote diversity in the team, that also applies for gender diversity. Like, Alpine also launched the Racer program in 2022 with the goal to increase diversity in all roles within the team, from drivers to engineers to other people working in technical roles. And during my preparation for this interview, I also came across a social media clip from Alpine that was also related to the Racer program. And there you also introduce yourself and your job a bit, just like you did at the beginning of this podcast. Is that also something that is close to your heart, to be actively a part of change at Alpine and in F1 in general by doing stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I always wanted to do a job where I could change the world in a positive way. As I said, I like people a lot. And there was a time where I thought, oh, I should be a doctor because doctors can, directly help people. That's something that I always wanted to do. I didn't really know that when I started working and I realized I wanted to become a leader, I realized, okay, a leader can change lives because they can improve people's lives at work and stuff. But I never thought that I was going to have so much exposure and it was going to give me the opportunity to actually, just by being here and just by talking to certain people, just showing the girls that actually you can do that. Because it is true that when I applied to the job, it's true that all I could see during my research and preparation was like the same white type of men, nothing wrong with it, but it makes you feel that you don't belong to that. It can make you feel that, why am I trying to do this? I don't think I'm going to be able to do it because I don't look like them. And, it's something that we don't have consciously, but it happens in our brain. So just by giving, the example and making them know that actually, yes, you look like me and you look like whoever you want to look. And it doesn't matter if you don't find yourself in the picture, you will put yourself in the picture. Just giving that to the people, it's very, very valuable. It's amazing. And obviously for me, it's like a dream come true. It's something that I always wanted to do. And it's one of the biggest things that this job is giving me, I think.
Do you also feel like you're having a real impact on the team? Like, are you also able to actively make suggestions on what more can be done to get more women into Alpine?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I feel really, really proud and very grateful. Because to be honest, since I arrived, people in human resources, Otmar himself, they've been listening to suggestions. There's been things that I've talked to them and I've said, look, this worked for me. I think we should do this. Okay, yeah, thank you very much. And they take it on board, And even when it sounds like, oh, it's just a training or it's just this or that, but actually it did make a difference in my career. Surely it's going to make a difference in someone else's career. And they take it on board. Honestly, they listen and they do things. Because once I spoke to Otmar and he said, well, the ideas might not come from me because I'm not the person, I'm not one of you. That's why I need you to tell me, because, you are the one who knows what we need here. So I need you to help me. And I think that's been amazing as well. And that's one of the reasons why I feel so happy in Alpine, because, I feel part of it. And I feel that, my voice is heard as well. So that's one of the most amazing parts as well.
And I mean, there are more and more women coming into the sport, right? But you don't reach milestones like having 30% females in a team within a few days or weeks. Like, the most important thing that is going to happen in the future, even if it doesn't happen overnight. I once interviewed Monisha Kaltenborn, the former team principal of Sauber, and she also said, like, women can do everything the men can do, but they need to be given the opportunities. And I think that's, what it's all about, basically. And I mean, there are different initiatives, like if it's from teams like the Racer Program by Alpine, or also Dare to be Different by Susie Wolf. I think the F1 Academy series also recently launched a program with Discover Your Drive that aims at, increasing diversity in the sport. Is there anything apart from that where you would say, okay, we or F1 or whoever need to do more of this or that to get more women into the sport? Or do you think we are already on a very good way right now?
I think we are doing very well. I think we also have to be preparing from the inside. And that's a point that I always like to make. It's not only about what we tell the people outside. It's important to reach out, but we also have to transform ourselves from the inside. So when people join, they are welcome. They are expected. People know what to do with them. And that's something that I am always highlighting. It's not only about external work, it's the internal work. It's just like, if you want to offer something to people, you need to change yourself from your inside. And it's the same here. And I think we are doing it. Don't get me wrong. We are doing it. But yeah, that's, why do you have to educate me as a female to tell me that I can be here? Why don't you educate your males as well, and you make sure that they know how to behave with me, they know how to welcome me, they know how to make me feel part of the team? But that's also part of the push that sometimes is not very much talked about. It's important, and we are doing it. And yeah, I think the other side of it is just making sure that people, we stop demanding perfection on females, and we just let them know that they can do everything they want, I believe.
Yes, I think that's very important indeed. And I think it's great that you have such a passion for that topic and you also come across as a person that really wants to inspire the next generation, which is very nice to see. And yeah, that's why it's a shame that we are slowly but steady coming to the end of this interview, because we are running out of time. Maybe one last question to finish it off. I think you maybe mentioned something you could answer on this question already in your previous answer, but is there anything that your job taught you or that you learned about yourself through your work that you can maybe pass on to the listeners that maybe want to start a career motorsport themselves? Is there any advice you can give?
Wow, that is a question that can reach many, many things. This is just probably one of the most recent things. Never doubt of yourself, because some people are going to have doubts about you. Some people are just going to be scared because they actually have no doubts that you're going to do very, very well. But they will want to put doubts on you. Don't buy that. I think that's the main thing. And that's one of the big lessons that I've had recently. You know, don't doubt yourself. If you think it's the right thing, just do it. Just do it. I mean, I think it is worse to regret not having done something than having done it and actually it didn't go as I wanted, or it wasn't probably the best thing. But I think the most important thing is just don't doubt yourself. Just if you think you can do it, it's because you can do it. If you think it's a good idea, it's because it's a good idea. Definitely.
Lovely. I think that's a very good answer to finish it off. One last thing. If people want to follow you on social media maybe or to get some more insight into your job, where can they find you? If you want to share that, of course, you don't have to.
I have my Instagram. I try to be active on Instagram, but I'm going to say something. I'm so busy that I just struggle. I'm always running from the factory to the gym to the house and then repeat. I'm Dahlia_Greenleaf on Instagram. And yeah, that's probably the easiest way.
So make sure to follow Dahlia there. And Dahlia, thank you so much for sharing all these stories with me and the listeners today. It was very interesting, at least for me. And I wish you all the best for your future and also for the rest of the season. And thank you for your time.
Thanks, Sophie, and thanks for the opportunity as well.
Und euch da draußen danke ich fürs Zuhören. Ich hoffe, ihr habt einen guten Eindruck bekommen von Dahlias Job als Head of Test and Build bei Alpine. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, dann lasst uns sehr gerne eine Bewertung oder Rezension da und dann hören wir uns ganz bald wieder hier bei Starting Grid im Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Keep racing!
Starting Grid, die Formel 1 Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Sophie Affeld in Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de. Keep racing auf meinsportpodcast.de.
Wieder live von Ihrem Toyota-Partner mit diesem Leasing-Auftakt. Der neue Toyota Yaris-Hybrid. Ab 179 Euro im Monat. Ohne Anzahlung. Seine Sicherheitsassistenten laufen mit. Und ja, ab ins Netz mit voller Konnektivität. Auch am Start die Toyota Team Deutschland Sondermodelle. Ohne Anzahlung geht's in die nächste Runde. Jetzt los sprinten zu Ihrem Toyota-Partner.
Von 0 auf 100. Aral feiert 100 Jahre mit über 100.000 Gewinnen. Zum Beispiel ein Jahr frei tanken. Jetzt ein Dankeschön, rubbellos zu jedem Einkauf. Alle Infos auf aral.de. Aral, alles super.